stepping stones.
Hi guys, my name's Elizabeth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Elizabeth.
Was it just me or did everybody that just come up here, his name was Michael? All three of you?
Yeah.
Okay. I was like, wait, this is starting to become a thing. thank you guys so much for having me here. I'm not having a bad day by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm having an emotional one. So if I cry, I'm just gonna cry. I don't do that a lot. Actually, when I got sober, there was a while where I thought that I was like, I don't know, maybe some type of like sociopath or narcissist, because I just couldn't cry, you know, unless I was feeling bad for myself, which that was often. But I'm a little scared right now. I think it's easier if I just say that, move past it. If I forget what I'm gonna say and I get quiet for a second, I'll relax into that and come back around. But I feel my voice shaking, so just bear with me. I really enjoyed the ride out here. If I'm being dead honest this morning, I was like, oh man, it's so far away. You know, because in my mind, I just complain about everything all the time. Big complainer. And I was really happy when I got off of work and I come from Philadelphia. And it was a really nice hour to just kind of be, right? Traffic wasn't anything crazy. 76 was fine. And I get off of the turnpike and I live in Philadelphia and I've lived in Philadelphia for a very long time now, but I'm from the Poconos. It's like driving down here, it reminds me of home, and it's absolutely beautiful. But I have a sobriety date. It's November 11, 2018, and that still feels so weird. It feels so weird to say. It always changed so much. It's definitely not my first sobriety date, as I just alluded to, given the fact of the amount of times it's changed. I have a sponsor, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's funny because when the gentleman was telling me that you guys have a website, I was like, oh, let me look this up real quick while I'm waiting for you guys to start reading. And I don't know what made me go to November 2021. That's just where I picked. And her name was there. And I was like, well, I don't think that's an accident. And I absolutely love that woman. The women and, you know, the men in Alcoholics Anonymous have helped to save my life. And on any given day, like, I'm just not one of those people that wakes up every day and I'm just like so grateful and I'm so happy. I wish I was. Like, I'm not knocking it, but I'm just self-centered. And usually when I wake up in the morning, I just think about how I don't want to go to work that day, or I don't want to have to drive anywhere after work, or just, you know, me. And I've been like so incredibly, just, I don't know, man, like, I don't want to use the word blessed. There's got to be a better word that has more significance to it, but maybe not, that there's been a village of people in Alcoholics Anonymous in Philadelphia that have kind of just like raised me from the minute I walked through the door over and over again. And so yeah, that's my sobriety date. I didn't pick it. I know people get up here and they're like, I didn't pick my sobriety date, but I didn't. Because I did pick it, and it was November the 10th. It wasn't November the 11th. I walked into my umpteenth treatment center at Episcopal Hospital down in Philadelphia because I needed help, and I was in bad shape. But by the time I got to the elevator, I didn't need that help anymore. I figured out myself. And I have a home group. It's Stepping Stones in Philadelphia, if you guys are ever in the area. It's a clubhouse. So I was telling the gentleman before we started, we have like 8 or 9 different meetings. We used to have 26 meetings a week before COVID. Now we have 8 or 9 with very hit or miss attendance. And but my home group that I attend regularly is a Wednesday night big book study at 7:30. Like I said, if you are ever down there, please come check it out. It's a great time. We have the people that sit down and break down the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, like, they are armed with the facts. And I've been in service, really, since the moment I got sober. I was told I had to. You guys told me that I had to. But I didn't have a sponsor that said, you have to do this and you have to do that. I probably wouldn't have listened. I'm not very good at listening. I watched what she did. And she was in service, so I was in service. And when she said, hey, maybe you should get a commitment at your home group, I did. And it was a Tuesday night coffee commitment. And I remember being terrified in the rooms of AA. Because even though I'd been in Philly for a while, I'm from the Poconos, so I didn't like know a ton of people. And we have a coffee bar where you have to pay for the coffee. I'd never been in AA where you have to go up and pay for the coffee. I was like, what's this? I'm broke. And if you don't have it, it's free. We give it to you. But we have someone that like serves it back there. And the beginnings of service were what made me become not so afraid to like walk into my home group every single week. Because walking into a meeting for the first time when you don't know anybody, it's a scary place. Like, you can walk into a small room, and it's really vast, and it's really big, and it's really terrifying. And I was the girl that would come in and sit in the back, or pretend I was on my phone so they didn't talk to me, and kind of, like, come in late and duck out early. And I was also the girl for a long time that would bounce in and out of treatment, and I would come out. Thank you so much. And say, I know what I need to do, I just have to do it. Right, that was me. I know what I have to do. I have no idea what I have to do, but I know what I have to do, I just have to do it. And I thought doing it was the problem, that wanting it was the problem. There was a really long time where I had people around me that would say things to my mom, and they would go, she must just not want it. And I promise you, I didn't want to do the things I was doing to get the next drink. I've been a blackout drinker since I was 12 years old. Since the very first time I picked up a drink, I remember it was a, I don't even know if they sell these anymore, but it was a Mickey's 40, right? I remember it was green, and it was cold, and it was wet, and I was drinking with a bunch of people that were older than me, and I don't know why 12-year-old little girl me had something to prove, but I did. And I was going to drink like they drank, and I got blackout drunk from the gate. And it's weird, because, like, I might have been a little older. I might have been, like, 30. But I have kids that age now. And I look at my kids. I have three boys. They're so cool. They're 13 and 16, and one's about to be 22. He's been the reason I've been crying all day. But it's because he's moving out. He's starting his life. And I couldn't be more proud. That's a pretty good reason to cry. And that was the kid that I was sober. God, wasn't brand new. I mean, I'm still brand new, you know, like 5.5 years in, this still feels brand new. But I remember he was the kid where I would text him every day, good morning, hi. And he would write back eventually and go, who's this? You know, so I didn't think that he was ever going to want to talk to me again, let alone like when I left for work this morning. All three kids were sleeping, all my three of my boys were sleeping in my house. And if you would have asked me 5.5 years ago if that was going to be a thing, I would have said no. I wouldn't have believed it. What I did believe was a lie that my head would tell me that my kids deserved, that they would be better without me. And man. When you guys said this, like, life beyond your wildest dreams, I don't want to confuse that with things or the restoration of relationships, because that doesn't always happen. Not in my time. It happens in God's time. But if you would have said, you know, life beyond your wildest dreams, and I probably would have wrote down a bunch of stuff. And what the gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded me is that when I left for work, I was able to pause, open each door, and be present for the moment to watch each one of my kids sleep, because I can be wide awake through life and rushing through it so fast. I miss those moments. I miss them all the time. But I say that about my son because my son is he's been home. He got done with his bachelor's in December. He's about to move down to Raleigh to join the fire academy. So he's got these few off months at his home, and it's been crazy, and he's really messy, and he never flushes the toilet. Like, I don't know what it is about boys and like not doing that, but like, it's not hard. Just, you know, push the handle down. And he started going, he's bored. He's not working, which it's fine. He doesn't need to. It's probably the last time in his whole entire life he's not going to have to work every day. He's about to like start a whole new life and a whole new career. So he's just kind of been hanging out, and he went to AA with me, which was really weird and unexpected because he's been at school, and before that he was in military school and high school and in junior college. So like, my kids know that I'm in AA, but they don't know like what goes on here. They don't know that like I'm doing step work when I say, oh, I have to go meet a friend, you know. They don't know that on Wednesday nights, like, I'm at my home group. But I was on my way out the door. I had to speak at the Northeast Club, which is a clubhouse down in Frankfurt in that part of the city. And he went, I think I'll go with you. And immediately I got terrified. I was like, oh, no, please don't. Like, I'm going to have to be so mindful of what I say. When I get up here, I really just kind of let whatever happened happen. You know, I don't think about it. And I'm like sweating bullets the whole entire way to this meeting, and it's an hour speaker, and he doesn't know that. He doesn't know what an AA meeting looks like. So I asked him, I said, we're driving down 95, and I was like, James, you've never been to anything like this before. Like, do you have any like expectation of what this is like? And he was like, oh yeah, I know exactly what goes on there. I watched it on an episode of Breaking Bad. So you go there, and I'm nervous, and I'm like, I thank God that a friend of mine came with her boyfriend, because my son knows her, and he could sit next to her, and he wouldn't be like as uncomfortable. And I get there, and I speak, and we leave. You know, it's an hour speaker. This is an hour speaker, right? Okay, good. I probably should have asked that first. Okay, so he keeps bringing up little like moments from that meeting, right? First of all, he's like, I had absolutely no idea what was going on. You didn't give anybody else a turn to talk. I thought that everybody goes around the room and they share their story for 5 minutes because that's what they do in Breaking Bad. And at first I'm listening to you and I'm like, okay, like, you know, this is going fine. And then I couldn't figure out why he wouldn't shut up. Like, I think that man in the back wanted to raise his hand. But to kind of get to the point of that, later on that night he goes, so funny that this program could really be for anyone. He goes, I think I want to make amends. I was like, excuse me? He's like, yeah, my ex-girlfriend's parents, I harmed them. I think I want to do that thing you were talking about, making amends. It sounds like a really good idea. And then a few days later, he's telling me about a fight he had with his girlfriend. He's like, well, I don't want her to end up on your list, so I don't want to tell you what she did. And I'm like, what list? He goes, that list you guys make of people you're mad at. I was like, oh my God, this is hysterical. And then he says to me the other night in the car, because since then he's been to the Stones with me like 2 times, and he goes, I didn't know you were an alcoholic. Like, I knew you had some stuff going on, but I didn't know you were an alcoholic. And I used to drink like that from the gate, like from the time you were a kid. And I was like, yeah, it's always been pretty bad, man. Like, I always drank like one of the guys. I've never been able to drink like a lady, if I'm being that honest. I don't think I've ever really tried. And he's like, well, that makes me a little nervous because that's how I drink. When I drink, I get blackout drunk. And in that moment, like, it really, it scared me. He barely drinks. Like, I've seen him drink once in the past 4 months. But I see the fear that my drinking has created in the people around me. He got his wisdom tooth taken out, and he wouldn't let them prescribe him anything because he was so incredibly afraid of that whatever runs through me, that he's going to catch it because he's my son. And that's just so wild to think about. Like, I never would have... Oh, it's a microphone. Sorry. I never would have imagined in a million years when I was doing all those things, the things that we do when we're drinking, I would never have imagined how far-reaching the effects of my alcoholism in other people's lives could be. My mom just said to me a few months ago, my mom doesn't know how long I've been sober. And when I tell you that she was on like the front line the whole entire time of my drinking, she was there. The woman does not drive a car. I ended up getting hospitalized in Philadelphia. And when I was drinking, she took a Greyhound bus to a taxi. She doesn't have a cell phone. She doesn't know what Uber is. To the hospital, just so she could come and make sure I didn't leave. Like, that's the kind of mom I have. And, but it's a miracle that she doesn't have to sit there and count my time. She doesn't have to worry about how long I've been sober. She doesn't have to think about it. And it was really cool because she said, you have no idea how happy it makes me you don't take your purse to the bathroom anymore. You just leave it on the table. And it's that small kind of stuff, like, I just don't think that we get, because for a long time, I held her hostage, just terrified all the time. And I was the kind of mom where, like, we say it, I think, a lot figuratively, but I've literally stepped over my own kids to go out the front door while returning the Christmas presents I got them the day before on my company credit card back to Target, telling them someone stole your new bike so that I can go drink. Like, that's the kind of mom I am. And it's crazy because that's not the kind of mom I was, because my 20s was really normal. It was a really normal life. Because I didn't really come from much of normal. I know it doesn't make me an alcoholic, my parents or my childhood growing up, but I think that it kind of like, it weaves itself into the story in a way, because growing up as a kid, like I come from a fairly decent sized Irish Catholic family, and alcoholism just runs through the veins of like our family tree. It goes deep. But if you took the four of us kids, myself, my two sisters, and my little brother, and was like, okay, who had it the worst? It was my little brother. He really did. And out of four of us, three of us are alcoholics, and it's not him. So that doesn't really add up. But when we were growing up, things were kind of chaotic, and there was a lot of drinking. And I'm from a small town. Is this a small town? Quakertown is a smallish kind of town? Well, the small town that I'm from, when you do something wrong, it ends up in the newspaper. So I don't know if this is that kind of town, but like, you get arrested, you go to jail, it ends up in the newspaper. And I remember being a little kid, and my parents had gotten into, this was it for them. They had bounced back and forth for so many years, but this was it for them. And it was this horrific fight. And it ended up with my father being arrested, and my mom being injured, and it ended up in the newspaper. And I remember going to school, and the kids that lived on my street weren't allowed to play at my house anymore because, you know. And if I'm being dead honest, I'm a parent. Like, I wouldn't let my kids at the crazy house either. But I remember as a girl, as a 9-year-old girl, what that felt like. And like, when you're a 9-year-old kid, like, can't identify what resentment feels like, you know, what shame feels like. But I remember being embarrassed from a really early age. Like, my dad looks like an outlaw biker that's like never ridden on a motorcycle. Big guy, not a leather jacket, but a jean jacket, like bandana, long hair. And he didn't look like the dads that the girls I went to Catholic school with looked like at all. And so if I had any example of what like I didn't want to be like, I had that in him, and I had that in a long time in my sisters who were older than me, and bless you, watching the things that they did. Like, as a kid, before I could put words to stuff, I knew that like things that went on in our home didn't go on in other people's houses. So I spent my teenage years just drinking like I did from the very first one I picked up. Like I said, I was a blackout drinker. I remember my mom was always like way too proud to ask for any type of help, although I'm sure she certainly qualified for it and said she just worked double shifts 7 days a week to put a roof over our head. And she would leave me $2, two $1 bills on the kitchen table every single morning for lunch because she was afraid it would be embarrassing to us if we had to walk up to the lunch lady and go, free lunch. Because that's what you had to say. Like, it wasn't on like a card. I don't know. My kids like punch in the little school ID number now. It wasn't like that. And I remember from that first drink, I would save my lunch money every single day until it was Friday and I had $10 and I could go out Friday night and drink in the woods with my friends. Like, I looked forward to that all week. And I didn't really get into any too crazy trouble, but I could recognize, like I said, from an early age, I would look around and everyone else is winding down at like 2 or 3 a.m., right? They stop drinking, and like that's when I get going. Like that's when I get started. Like, alcohol does not have a sedating effect on me. It has a very stimulating effect where I put a drink in me. What are we doing next? Where are we going? Who are we calling? Like, you're not gonna see me for 2 or 3 days until like I run out of steam or out of money. And when I was just out of high school, I found out that I was pregnant with that 22-year-old boy. He's almost 22. He'll be 22 in May. And It talks about it in the book. I had sufficient reason to stop drinking, so I did. I remember moments of being pregnant and like, I'm 19 years old. I can't drink with my friends anymore. So like, that kind of sucks. And like, me and his dad didn't make it past me being 6 months pregnant. That didn't work out. And I grew up. I grew up with a lot of support from my mom, and I got my first little place, and it was just, sorry. It's just me and this little boy who's like this now. And we carved out a life, you know. I got a good job. I had better insurance when I was 19 than I do right now. For great benefits. And went back to school and we figured it out. And I met a guy who I, you know, had a crush on when I was 12, because we live in a small town, and like, you know, me and Ben get married and we have two more babies. And in the middle of, you know, that decade, my dad had had my little brother with his, not his wife, they were never married, but with the woman that he left my mom for. Talk about resentment. And oddly enough, my mom was the one who always made sure that me and my little brother were close. I didn't notice, like, it's funny the things that you look back on as an adult and be like, I could never. She used to watch my brother for days at a time, so that they could hold themselves up for 4 or 5 days to go through physical withdrawal symptoms of other substances. And my mom would take care of my little brother, so he was always around when I was little. And when I got married and I had my kids, I think by the time I was like 26 years old, and my brother had been in foster care for a few years. That was never my experience. My mom kind of always held us down, but like, he had to rely on my dad. And like, his mom, who my dad was the better parent of the two, and then, not to be unkind, but that just wasn't saying much, you know. He just didn't have it good as a baby. And but anyways, when he was 11, he came to live with me and my husband and my kids, and we adopted him through the state of Pennsylvania. We went through the family kinship program, which is really just like going through the same exact foster care program that any other foster parents do. Background checks, classes, yada, yada, yada. He comes and he lives with us when he's 11. And I have this really good life. I have the kind of life that I wish I would have had as a kid, right? I have a minivan, little TV slip down, and I'm the kind of mom that I can bring cupcakes into school on my kids' birthdays. Like, my mom couldn't do that kind of stuff. She was always at work. Like, my kids could, like, go on field trips. Like, we just knew not to ask my mom for field trip money because we didn't want to make her feel bad that she wouldn't have it. And you're like, I'm on the PTA and I'm like a literal soccer mom driving this silver minivan to soccer practices and all that kind of stuff. My little brother's with us, and like, okay, now I have this good life and you come with me and like, you can have this good life too. And what I had absolutely no idea of, and if you would have tried to tell me, like, I would have been like, you're nuts, was about the progression of alcoholism, because I put a drink down when I was 19 years old. And when I was 29 years old, I picked it back up. And I remember going to this bar in the Poconos. And we were going out for my husband at the time. It was his 30th birthday. I remember it was August the 12th. And I couldn't tell you what year it was. But we go into this bar, and I remember having like a very clear idea in my mind, very, very conscious thought, this is a very bad idea. Like, I knew, like, looking down, I'm like, the trajectory of my life is going to change. And then I thought, it's different now. I'm not a kid, you know, I'm an adult. And within 6 months, I had lost the job that I had worked for these people for 10 years. I had managed to steal $20,000 from the people that gave me my job. That was also my landlord, so now I have no house. And in the midst of all of this going on, I pull in my driveway one day, and the same woman who walked us through the foster care certification process to adopt my little brother was there to take my kids. And I wasn't the kind of mom that got her kids taken away until they were there to take my kids. And I remember when things got really bad before that happened, I remember thinking, if anything happens with the kids, I'll stop. That'll be enough, I'll stop. And we have this crazy delusion that, like, nobody knows, right? Nobody knows what we're doing. Nobody knows how bad I'm drinking. I think that it's okay to still be drinking at 6, 7 a.m. if you haven't gone to bed yet. Only alcoholics wake up and drink, but if I haven't gone to bed yet, then that's okay. Like, this is the kind of stuff I tell myself, and it's nuts. And that just kind of, that kicked off a lot of years of pain. It kicked off me just being a victim and being like, well, I drink because you took my kids. You know, do you have any idea how painful it is to have your children removed from your custody? I remember I used to have to go to this room and there was a woman that would sit in the corner and like write stuff down while I would be in there visiting my kids in a sweatshirt in the middle of July because like I couldn't take it off. And just using that as a reason, like I've used every single reason in the world to drink. We had lost my cousin who, like, I grew up next door to my cousin. I don't know if anyone in this room has that close cousin, like, thing where, like, your cousin is your first best friend. Like, that was my cousin. We lived right next door to each other. We grew up together. And back around, I want to say, like, 2013, 2014, we lost him as a direct result of this disease. And I remember being in the ladies' room at his funeral, and I got caught drinking in the bathroom. And I blamed his death as a reason for my pain and why I shouldn't be shamed for what I was doing. It was a lot of excuses. It was a lot of thinking that alcohol was the problem for a really long time. If I was just separated from alcohol for long enough, then I would be okay. And then what ends up happening is I'd be starting to become separated from alcohol all the time. And usually not by choice for lots of different reasons. It's either, you know, to get my kids back, or it's a law enforcement separation from alcohol, or it's a treatment facility, or it's something somehow. And I go there and I really think that like that's gonna do it. If you just put me in this place for 21 to 28 days until my insurance kicks me out, I'm gonna get out of here and I'll be fine. Like, I know what I need to do, I just have to do it. I have to go to these meetings, right? That's it. I just gotta come here. And I had absolutely no idea what I was up against, because for a really long time I thought, like, when I come in here and I say that I'm an alcoholic and I tell you what my name is, then that's where it starts and that's where it stops. And I really think that, like, when I look at the first step on the wall, that's not the steps. That's the steps. That, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life is incredibly unmanageable right now. Like, I just can't get a sober breath. But I had absolutely no idea that, like, my alcoholism really kicks into effect the minute I stop drinking. The moment you separate me from alcohol, I hate it. I absolutely hate it. But it's a fickle thing, right? It is kind of baffling and powerful because, like, my mind will delude me to think that I'm okay until I'm walking around with a year and a half sober, not having done any of these things. Wondering why I want to jump in front of traffic and thinking to myself, if this is what being sober feels like, I don't want it. Because that's what sobriety felt like to me. It felt like you can't breathe, you know? And thank God I had this woman say to me, she said, how long can you hold your breath? The reason it's cunning, baffling, and powerful is because it tricks me into thinking I'm okay, because as the result of the separation from alcohol, it doesn't take that long for my life to start to look better on the outside. Give me 3-6 months and I can get a job. I might be able to get a car depending on how long I got my license suspended for this time. I probably will put on a little bit of weight. He'll start talking to me again. I'm getting to see my kids and and everything goes well for a time. But what our book talks about, it says that over any considerable period of time, we get worse, never better. But I have it completely backwards. Like, I think the worst is over and I can only get better, relying solely on myself for that. I remember one time I got 5 months and 29 days. It was the first time I ever started going to AA. And I remember being in meetings and there was a lot of things I didn't understand. I didn't believe a lot of people were happy and sober. I didn't believe that you really did have to do all this stuff. It looks like a lot of work. And I remember being like, oh God, I'm lazy. And there's so many things that you guys have said to me, these like little one-liners, right? Not the slogan, but the one-liners that stuck with me. And I remember saying something about being just like too lazy to do this. And a woman in a meeting looked me in the face and she went, "Are you lazy or are you afraid?" And that stuck with me for the last 10 years. I was like, oh, maybe she's on to something there. But my train of thought just went right out my ears. I started to hear things, you know. And when I got that 5 months and 29 days, I remember I had driven up from Philly. My kids were living with my mom at the time. And we had a beautiful day. I took them roller skating for the very first time. And they were probably like, I don't know, God, 4 and 6, which don't ever do that. Like trying to take a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old on roller skates for the first time, like one's flying this way, one's falling this way and crying. I'm like, oh my God. It was funny. I have good pictures from that day. We had a great time and beautiful day. And all I know is I hit Interstate 80 with 5 months and 29 days sober. And my next thought was like, I should just get 4. Just get 4. And that's exactly what I did. And I remember this woman talking to me about the phenomenon of craving. She's like, you have to be careful. This is going to happen again. And I was like, no, it's not. I don't want to. Because I think I have the power of choice. I think I learned my lesson because I got sick and I got in trouble. And I have no idea what I'm up against. And those similar experiences, they just recycle, right? They just look like different people are around and different kind of consequences. And we start to experience these depths of loneliness that I didn't think were possible. My last few sprees, the year I got sober, lasted for very short bursts of time from, let's just say, August to that November. It was 3 days here, 5 days sober, 4 days out, 2 weeks sober. And I just couldn't figure out what the problem was. And I remember on November the 11th, I was staying at somebody's house because I had absolutely nowhere to go. And they had let me stay at their house for a day so I could figure it out. And my best idea is to figure it out November the 12th and just kind of lay around on this person's couch and feel sorry for myself all day. And at this point, like, I have nobody left. Like, nobody really wants to talk to me. I didn't really lose anything this time because I hadn't gotten anything back to lose. You know, I had gone well past the times where I could really build the structure up and tear it down. Because, like, I couldn't even get any footing. And I got a phone call on the 11th, and it was my friend calling me. And she called me a few times, but I don't know about you guys. Like, I don't answer my phone, like, when I'm feeling bad for myself. And not only that, but I'm sick enough where, like, I won't answer my phone on purpose so that you worry about me. Like, that's even, like, another layer of being crazy there. Selfish to the core. And she's blowing on my phone. I finally enter and she says, "We got you a bed in treatment. Put your shoes on. They're going to be there in 40 minutes and pick you up." And I remember sitting there and trying to calculate in my head. I didn't want to go, but I'm scared of her. Like, I don't know if anyone else has a friend they're just like a little bit afraid of. But like, Ange, I'm a little bit afraid of her. And trying to calculate the time it would take me to get from where I'm at to where I need to go and get back here in 40 minutes so I can do what I need to do and not miss this ride. And it was impossible. I have absolutely no resources. And in that moment, like, I sat down. I just sat down and with my shoes on, and I waited for this man to come and pick me up. And it's not like I had anything to pack because it was already in my, like, my little duffel bag that I would carry around with me from the day before when I didn't need help. And when I got out of that treatment facility, which I had a lot of time there, think they had just opened a new inpatient treatment facility down in, like, the Port Richmond neighborhood in Philadelphia, and I was the only patient. It was like The Shining. It's 6 floors, everything's white, shiny, brand new, smells like a hospital, and it's just me. I'm the only patient. They scholarshiped me there. I don't think they had, like, insurance stuff figured out, so they couldn't bring people in. So it was all me all the time. Try going to groups at rehab where it's just you and, like, 4 people that work there. And I had a lot of time to think in that facility, and it talks about in our book as the jumping off point. Like, I remember staring out the window at night when I couldn't sleep, just wondering what my life looked like, because I couldn't picture my life sober. It felt like a sentence, like one day at a time, every day, like forever. Not that one. And like, I couldn't picture my life drinking. It certainly didn't look like a very long one. And for a while I was kind of cool with that. Like I had made peace, like, okay, this is just how we go. You know, kids will be better off without me. Like, thank God they have a really good dad. And I got out of there, and I remember going into this recovery house that I had lived in a dozen times and being in the kitchen. And have you ever been at war with yourself and like your own mind? And I just remember being like, how did we do it again, self? How did we get here again? Why does this always happen? And it was like this window opened where it was like all of a sudden I could see so very clearly that up until that point that like it's not alcohol, like, because I drink when like my list of needs is checked off that I made when I got sober, and I have all my stuff back. And I drink when I have nothing, with a job, without a job, with a license, without a license, with money, no money, like no matter what I drink. Like when I lost my kids and I got custody of them back because I stayed sober, I drank the next day. Make it make sense. Makes absolutely no sense. And that was the first time in my life, like, I wasn't no stranger to God. I don't have any problems with God. Like, common thing, I hear a lot of people say it, you know, that there's a resentment against God. Like, and if that's your thing, like, that's what you had going on. But mine was just that I was so self-centered. There was no need for God. Like, I'm God. Why do I need a God in my life? Like, why do I need this higher power? Like, I would hear people say, like, oh, thanks to God and AA, we have this much time sober. And I'd be like, no, I did this. Like, that's how my brain thinks. And I pray when I'm in trouble, and that's about it. And I would pray when someone was sick, and it kind of would end there. I've had plenty of like, God, please do this for me, and I'll go to church every Sunday, like I promise. And like, you know, God would come through or not, and like I'm not showing up to service on Sunday. Bless you. But I was in this kitchen, and I just remember being at that jumping off point, like again, like, what am I going to do? And I remember like literally crying out to God. Like dropped to my knees, begging God for like, I guess what we call willingness, because I remember I asked God, like, God, I want this. Like I don't want this, but I want to, right? Like everybody else looks like they want this. They want to do this stuff. Like they want this relationship with you. And like, I don't, but I want to. I would really like to have that. And it's just been my experience that God shows up through people. And my friend Marie called me and she said, we're going to come and pick you guys up and we're going to take you to this meeting down in Delaware. And it was a big book study on Tuesday night. It's called the Newport Breakdown. It's a great meeting if you're ever in Wilmington. But I remember walking into that room and it's massive. And there's like, oh my God, it felt like a million people in there. And like, I don't know, man, like everybody seemed happy. And like when they were breaking down the book, like I could hear. And I, in that moment, like I just felt okay. And I started to go through my steps again, and the woman that had sponsored me the last few goes where I had, you know, tried this, she came over and she sat in that same kitchen with me at that kitchen table, and she opened the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she started to take me through my steps again. And like Sarah didn't say anything different than she did the first two or three times we sat down with that same book at that same table. I was just always kind of hoping she had a different answer. I had my own answers, and this is the moment where like God can start to enter in the picture, because I'm completely out of ideas and I have no idea what to do. And then I think that when we get to that moment of desperation, we just start to kind of crack open and allow other things to come in. And that's what we did. Like, we went through this work and we went through it in sequence. We went through it in momentum, and I stayed in service. And there was a couple things I did a little bit different this time. One of them was being taught the set aside prayer, which you guys opened your meeting with. And if that is not one of my favorite and most frequently used prayers, I don't know what is. And I'm so grateful that somebody taught it to me. And they taught me how to be flexible and interchangeable with it. I called my sponsor on Wednesday, and I was terrified. I have a different sponsor now, but I call her on Wednesdays at 5 o'clock. That's like our appointment, because I'm not so great at keeping in touch, and she's very busy. Coolest thing I think she ever said to me was, I worked up the courage to ask her to sponsor me. I think I was like 3 years sober at the time, but I'm like terrified to ask anybody for anything still ever. I'm like, oh, she's busy. What if she says no? And she said to me, she goes, remember, we suffer from the same thing. And I don't know, that just kind of always stuck with me, that like, I don't have these crazy expectations of Claire to revolutionize my life, because she's just an alcoholic like me, right? Just eyeball to eyeball. She's not like all the way up here. she had me use it last week. She goes, well, did you say the set-aside prayer? And I didn't know I could use it in the context of, hey, God, help me set aside everything I think I know about going into my kid's IEP meeting for school, because he really needs help and I'm afraid because I've never done this before. And, like, wouldn't you know, it helped. Because when, like, everything's at a 10 in my head, I forget, like, all of the things that we've ever been taught to do, and I just, like, run on fear. But, and when they taught me the set-aside prayer, to set aside everything I thought I knew about writing inventory and doing a fifth step, because I was so blocked off to the idea that there could be any change. Like, in the fifth step promises, it says, like, we can look the world in the eye. Like, I've never been able to look the world in the eye. Like, I'm probably looking down at the floor. And we had a really cool experience with that, because I finally got honest about some things that I had left off every other inventory I'd ever done. And the funny thing about that is, I don't know if anybody in this room has this experience, but when I leave things off my inventory, or if I'm doing an 11 step and I'm not getting honest about something that I've kept to myself that I should have shared with another person at once, it starts to be this, like, this low hum in the back, like the background of my mind. And then it gets louder, and then it gets louder. And the next thing I know, I'm drunk and I don't know why. And so I remember calling her in tears, being like, I left something off. I was so afraid to drink this time, because I would come in and, like, you guys would say, like, if you don't do this, this will happen. And it had been my experience for the past 10 years that I didn't do this and that thing happened. And the book, it talks about, like, a life and death errand. Like, when I got sober, by no means, it was not a miserable time, but it was a very busy time. It was, you know, meetings, and they were picked out for me. I didn't get to pick my meetings in the recovery house. They were Monday, Wednesday, Friday, big book studies. And now I know why that woman did that, because we would have just been going to the meetings at the clubhouses and hanging out in the back with the guys, which is fine. But it's only going to get you so far, you know? And she would come to our house meeting and go, well, do you know the fear prayer? And I thought this was like a pop quiz. And again, I'm a little afraid of her too. So, like, I learned where that stuff was in the book. I had the kind of people in my life where if I went, well, what does that mean? They would be like, I don't know, go find it, you know? and when we finally got to the point of making amends, I had tried to make amends. Oh my God, this is like cringy, embarrassing. Tried to make amends in the past to people. And there's a reason why we are given instruction on how to make a proper amends. I remember, like, years and years ago, feeling moved in the moment. Don't do this. Feeling moved in the moment to make an amends to my mom. I'm not even on that step. We're at that cousin who passed away grave. We're leaving flowers. In the moment, I am just moved to tell my mom, I'm sorry, but do you remember the $150 I gave you for the electric bill, and that you lost it and I helped you look for it? I took it. And I've never seen my mom so hurt in my entire life. And then I still didn't pay her back the $150. So that's a story on how not to make amends. And this time around, there was absolutely no motive in making amends. I made amends to the people talks about in the book. It says, you know, when we take like the bit in our teeth and we go to the person that we hated. And I believe it's using the past tense, because at this time, I'm looking at it through an entirely different lens now, and I'm no longer holding on to that kind of resentment. And I was able to make amends to my father before he passed away. I was able to sit down with him on a beautiful day in Florida when that little brother married his wife, who's in labor right now. So excited. And look my dad in the eye and admit my mistakes, whereas I, you know, was in our relationship, how I used that resentment I had from him as a 9-year-old kid to punish him his entire life. And not allowing him to have a relationship with me or my children because I was angry. Because that's what I do when I resent you. I just kind of keep you all the way over there. And when we got to like the sponsorship part, which I was absolutely terrified of, I had never done that in all the attempts that I had made to get sober. And I shouldn't have been allowed to, right? Because I wasn't doing the things before it. But at this time, my sponsor like lovingly encouraged me that like, and the 10-step promises, how it talks about, I'm sorry, the 9-step promises, like no matter how far down the scale that we've gone. And I was able to to start being of service to the other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember going down to this recovery house in South Philly. And I didn't drive when I got sober for a really long time. That's why the first year was hard, because everywhere was on foot. It was on city buses that I don't know how to take. And I remember calling my friend Ricky and being like, I don't know what I'm doing and I'm scared and I don't sound like you guys. And he said, you know what you're doing, you'll be fine. And he hung up the phone. And I walked out of that house like levitating 6 inches off the ground. And I was like, oh my God, this is it. And I had texted my friend Marie and I was like, this is what was missing. Like, this is it. And I think that when we start to become involved in service at a level of sponsorship, we really start to begin to feel like we're a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember hearing an old timer say once that if you're sober and you're an AA and you're not sponsoring other people because you don't want to, that you are as selfish as the first day that you walked in here. And that's just always been something that stuck inside my gut. And that if you're not inconvenienced by service, that you're probably doing it wrong. But it's been like such a crazy ride the last few years. Like, I don't think I could really paint a picture of how Alcoholics Anonymous has transformed my life. Every day I fall short on like being in awe of the miracle that the obsession to remove, like the obsession to remove, that's not what we say. The obsession to drink has been removed, because that's not what I thought I was signing myself up for. I thought I was signing myself up for like a lifetime of holding on to the bottom of my seat. But what had happened was is that like when you guys said, hey, do these things, and I would do those things not wanting to. Like, I wasn't like, yes, we're going to talk about God. I was more like, I've always had a bad attitude. So I was like, God, that's all you guys talk about, like when I first got here. And I just never would have imagined the levels of freedom that coexist with every single one of these steps. It might not be your experience where you do a 5th step and your life is magically transformed. It wasn't mine. I felt a little bit lighter, but when I made amends, you couldn't touch me. I was like, oh my God, you guys weren't lying. This really works. Because I had started to feel a type of peace in my life that I had never experienced before. I call my mom now sometimes just to ask her how she is, you know. I know her birthday is October the 12th. When my dad passed away, I was able to be the one that called my little brother and say, hey, I need you to get on a plane and come say bye to daddy with me. And not only that, but be the one who like showed up and kind of like handled stuff. If you would have asked me with, you know, what does life look like beyond your wildest dreams, I would have told you that I stayed married. And I didn't. When I got sober, he was done for real this time. He meant it. And I had to go through a divorce sober, and I was fine. I was okay. And I didn't think I would find that kind of love twice, and I did. And the coolest part about it is, as the result of the principles of this program, showing up and making amends, my ex-husband took my 13-year-old son to his first Eagles game on Christmas with my fiance. Like, baseball starts tomorrow night. Like, the three of us will sit by each other the entire season. And that is so far different than what I in life, like, thought my life would look like. But it's it's not like when I grew up, my parents couldn't be in the same room. So, like, if amends to my kids means having this great relationship with their dad, who's a friend of mine, and that they never have to hear two people fight, like, we don't even have a custody arrangement. One of my kids went back to his house today. The other two are still there. He might come back Thursday. We just kind of let them, like, you want to go to your dad's? I'm not going to say no. You want to be with your mom? We're not going to say no. I bought a house closer to their dad so that, like, we could do this thing together. But, like, 5 years ago, like, I would have painted this picture like this man was keeping my children from me and ruining my life, and that's just not what it looks like. Because for a really long time, we're just so self-centered, I can't see past my own face, and I didn't know what that meant for a really long time. And I don't know where anybody in this room is at, but if you're new, like, I beg of you to just do the work, you know, to stop being afraid and do the work, because you have absolutely no idea, like, the kind of, my life is very boring. I go to bed at 9 o'clock every night, and I wouldn't want anything more than that. To go in my own bed in my own house where I'm safe and I feel at peace, and, like, I can just be in that space and be okay. But that's all I have, guys. Thanks for letting me share. I'll move my cup. I'm one of the people that leaves their coffee cup in the attention.
The group would like to thank Elizabeth again for sharing her experience with us tonight. The group would also like to remind anyone in need of a sponsor to please see someone after the meeting. Would anyone who has working knowledge of the 12 steps please raise your hand? Thank you. Please help us close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Elizabeth, you want to take us out?
Sure.
Lord's Prayer?
Our Father,
who art in heaven.